name, place, and convenient and immediate on Jewish historian will get to is the theme of our second paper, which is being written by Professor Jeffrey Gruen. Professor Jeffrey Gruen is Lady Kaufmann's professor of Jewish history. Professor of Jewish history at Bernard Levels. Levels Graduate School at Yeshiva University. Professor Gruen has a master degree and PhD degree from Columbia University, and soon after he completed his doctoral dissertation, he started to teach at the Bernard Levels Graduate School at Yeshiva University, and occasionally as a sign of recognition at the place to see the school and the Yale University to some of the seminars. Professor Gruen has widely written on his subject on American Jewish history. He is an author of many studies, articles, and books. But I cannot hesitate to say here that 1988 is Professor Gruen's year. 1988, Professor Gruen has seen the publication of the Rabbi Shimon Huberman's volume, which he edited together with the Rabbi Robert Hill, and which was published together with the Yeshiva University Press. In 1988, his book on the history of Yeshiva University appeared just a couple of weeks ago, published by Columbia University Press. And finally, also the year is just at the beginning, in 1988, he was nominated as the full professor at the Bernard Levels Graduate School at Yeshiva University. It's my great honor to introduce Professor Gruen to you.
Their understanding of 20th century American Jewish immigrant life was influenced strongly by an uncritical acceptance of an early and tendentious description of the texture of medieval Jewish life, and they ascribed static patterns of immigrant behavior based on observations of life in one city and among one particular immigrant group to all localities and all new immigrants within the United States. Yet, the theories developed in the 1920s by Robert E. Park, Ernest W. Burgess, and most importantly for us, Lewis Wirth, all of what came to be known as the University of Chicago School of Sociology stood unchallenged by scholars for more than two generations, and even today still informs discussions of time, place, and movement in immigrant Jewish, and second-generation ethnic historiography. Writing as they did at the opening of the interwar period, and the calls of nativism and for 100% Americanism transcended the street to pervade the academy and ultimately American governmental policy, theirs was an optimistic message, arguing in social science the possibilities of immigrant assimilation into a broad American polity. They wrote with confidence of the wide applicability of the research findings. As such was the legacy of 1910 progressivism of which they still felt a part. They were of that tradition which believed that if you create a study model and study it well, you can predict beyond that initial example and readily project findings to other places and other times. It was Burgess who in 1923 offered a model drawn from Chicago which tightly linked immigrant economic conditions and mobility with well-defined residential concentrations. His consensus zone theory divines that all 20th century American cities possess four areas of settlement spinning off and out of a downtown central business financial district, an area that was initially the core of the city. For those of us acquainted with New York, the Wall Street area might immediately come to illustrate the Chicagoan's point. Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, the Battery Park for Wall Street area was New York City, except that Battery Park, which is in fact landfill, was not yet in existence. Most areas north of Wall Street were farmland. And of course, Brooklyn, Long Island, which Queens is a part, and the later Annex District, known to us as the Bronx, were either legally or geographically separate from the city. Obviously, by the 19th and 20th centuries, Wall Street had become what it is today, and in significant part what Burgess described as a classic central business zone. This district was characterized as home to very few residential inhabitants, as it served as the central retail district, the financial hub, and the locus of civic and political activities. The central business zone is encircled by what Burgess calls the area of first settlement or the zone in transition. Other euphemisms like Little Italy, the ghetto, or the black belt were also used by the sociologists. Simply put, it is a slum area. As Burgess explained it, this section was once in the early 19th century a suburb of private homes and land. But now, as a long-time victim of the burgeoning of the late 19th century city, it is pockmarked by tenements and blighted by factories and sweatshops, near and in the buildings where the poorest immigrants and blacks have to reside. They have no choice. They must be near their work as they labor in terribly long hours and cannot afford rent elsewhere. At best, it is an area, quote, from which the most enterprising and aspiring individuals hope and ultimately do escape. Again, for us New Yorkers, that description at first glance seemingly could be applied to the Lower East Side. It certainly was true of Chicago's Neo West Side, Burgess's actual study area. And as the sociologist had it, what was true in the Windy City held by extension to all other cities. Those on the way up economically, quote, skilled and, quote, thrifty factory and shop workers, or more often than not their children, are moved and placed by Burgess into the zone of working men's homes or, quote, the area of second settlement, a region of escape from the ghetto, to quote Burgess. It is a better built neighborhood, with elevator apartments predominating as nice brownstones highlight the neighborhood. Burgess called his Lawndale section Chicago Deutschland and intimated in passing what it means socially for immigrants to live uptown, to use a New York expression, by describing Deutschland as the district where Russian Jews attempt to imitate the German Jews. For Burgess, great American cities are home to two final concentric economic zones. The area of third settlement, the so-called better residential zone, situated toward the outskirts of the city, is the home of the great American middle class, the place and status towards which the best of the immigrants and surely their children are heading. Residents in these neighborhoods, where private homes predominate, are often professional people. Minimally, they are high school educated and are employed in white collar occupations. Finally, 1920s American cities are said to have slowly emerging commuter zones, this country's first 20th century suburbs, sitting astride the city limits. If you want to live in this private home district, the sociologist made clear, you had better have some money and an automobile, and it would help significantly if you were a WOP. For himself, Burgess was troubled that in the commuter zone, residential restrictions were based on more than just economics. Now, the historical interpretive narrative attached by Burgess to his zone theory was that all immigrants entered into first settlement areas and over time moved up and out towards the outskirts of the city. For him, an immigrant's residential address would tell it all. He was in certain agreement with what one of his progressive contemporaries had said in a popular vein about newly successful New York Jewish businessmen of the 1920s, quote, the further uptown they move, the larger one can be sure is his bank account, unquote. And as the 1920s progressive himself, Burgess was also certain that what was becoming true of immigrants would ultimately be true, too, of intra-American migrants as well. Blacks from the South would join Jews and others on the road to suburbia if only the WOP out there would accept those who are making it. Burgess had no sense of aspiring and achieving blacks being stopped early in their move outward, but that is a topic for another time. Burgess left it to his colleague Robert E. Park to describe and to predict what this inevitable immigrant march to suburbia meant to the new American sense of ethnic, religious, or racial cohesion. Park argued that first settlement areas were homes to slowly changing traditional societies made up of individuals who held transplanted European identities. Second settlement neighborhoods were made up of the acculturating in the throes of breaking away from the old way. In fact, the most dramatic expression of their new self-definition was their actual physical move from the ghetto. Still in all, these migrants were not fully at home in America. They were marginal people, struggling still both with their new national American identity and with the greater impersonality and decreased social stability that comes with new affluence, Americanization, and declining propinquity to their own kind. The reconciliation of marginality, it was predicted, would come in the third and latter areas of settlement. There, if Americans would only allow immigrants, and for that matter blacks, to settle, the acculturated newcomers would feel wholly part of American society, live among all types and peoples, and contribute to the advancement of our homogenized nation. Altogether, Burgess and Park offered their interwar society an optimistic, progressive vision of the resolution of America's racial, immigrant, and ethnic problems. All minority groups were destined to move up the economic immigrantial ladder and will seek out their earned position if those who preceded them will only let them do as much. Equally important, these newcomers to America and or to the city were right for the warranted values of assimilation and will, again, if given a chance, identify wholly with the majority society. It remains for Burgess's and Park's student Lewis Wirth to focus his teacher's observations and predictions about cities, social life in ghettos and beyond that pale, and movement towards affluent integration and assimilation upon the quintessential immigrant minority group, the Jews. And it is here in Wirth's full-length monograph on Chicago Jewry called The Ghetto, published in 1928, as the work of Chicago school fully entered American Jewish historiography. It could almost be anticipated that Wirth would find the city his Midwestern Jews encountered corresponded in most of its salient features to the model developed by Burgess. They were both studying Chicago, and when Wirth took his mentor's teachings out of the seminar room to the streets for his observations, predictably, he was able to see and ready to show that each Jewish section had its own physical and economic character and served as home to a particular class of Jew. Wirth's affinity for what Park had to say about the social qualities among Jews in each of the settlement areas was even greater. Not only could he verify by his own observations what he had learned at university about Jewish life in the contemporary ghetto, but he could project his findings widely because it appeared to him that what Jews were then doing in Chicago was in full consonance with his understanding of Jewish history. He had learned, seemingly from the reading of two early histories of medieval and modern Jewry, that Jewish life in historical involuntary ghettos of the past was closed, unchanging, and falsified. Moreover, he had been brought to understand, quote, that the Jew, as long as he finds himself enclosed by ghetto walls, is not only helpless, but extremely naive about the world around him. Thus, when he saw seemingly the same behavior patterns in Chicago, he was prepared to say that although America did not prescribe specific ghetto areas to Jews, Jews bound by their history gravitated to ghettos not only, quote, because of its accessibility and low rent, but also by tradition. One can see Wirth's sense of the European ghetto being replicated in America when he wrote, quote, the American ghetto is a complete world, but it is a small and narrow one. It has intellectuals, but their intellect is of a circumscribed sort. What it lacks in breadth of horizon, it makes up in emotion. It is almost completely cut off from the world, as if it was still surrounded by a wall and its inhabitants were still locked behind ghetto gates. Clearly, American Jewish historiography would have evolved quite differently if Rourke had had access to what we know now of a validated social, intellectual, and economic profile of medieval Jewry. Without his own early faulty historical precedent to buttress his assumptions, he might have been able to see the difficulties of projecting widely such an overarching understanding, the very problem we shall deal with momentarily. Unfortunately, Rourke teaches in this regard Israel Abraham's author of Jewish Life in the Middle Ages, and David Phillips, an author of the Reform Movement in Judaism, have neither the skills nor the objectivity of our contemporaries. Abraham, the English liberal Jewish leader and his American Reform counterpart, were consistently intent on contrasting the closed nature of medieval Jewish life, complete with a description of the Jew as culturally and socially backward, to the newly open, vibrant, modern Jewish society, home to the worldly Jew, a transformation achieved due to Gentile largesse, a bounty of emancipation. So they argue, Abraham and Philistine, that so long as Jews were kept apart from Gentiles, Jewish life suffered. Now in the modern period, thanks to the opening of society, Jews are changing, improving, and Gentiles could expect that greater freedom and acceptance of the Jew will inevitably lead to Jews taking an even greater earned place in the contemporary liberal world. If early Jewish historiography skewered when Rourke knew of historical ghetto, contemporaneous American and American Jewish historiography offers literally no other study of immigrant or immigrant Jewish life, and few examinations of the American city against which Rourke's present-day understanding, and for that matter his mentor's conceptualization, could be fairly compared. American historians, writing in the generation which immediately preceded the appearance of Marcus Lee Hansen's seminal work, The Immigrant in American History, showed little positive interest in detailing and evaluating the contribution and character of new Americans. Indeed, when they did write about immigrants, and remember, their studies were at least several steps removed from those they were studying. Most American historians have neither the linguistic abilities nor the cultural skills to get close to the immigrants. Their tracks were rife with what one historian has called the Mayflower Complex, the very nativist disposition against which Burgess, Rourke, and Park had struggled. American Jewish historians, for their part, were also consumed by their own Mayflower Complex, their attempt in filial pietism and apologetics to argue the early presence of the Jews in the United States even before the arrival of the Mayflower. So directed, the well-meaning amateurs who peopled the American Jewish Historical Society had no time for the realia of the immigrant period that had just ended. Even the amateur historian closest to the immigrants, a man who spoke their language and knew their ways, newspaper editor Peter Vernick of the Morning Journal, offered no conceptualizations to his interesting relating of fact. In fact, the truth be told, as I indicated earlier, if Rourke and his friends had looked for popular approbation for their sense of Jewish migration and settlement patterns, they had to look no further than the classic and best-selling immigrant novel of their time, Abraham Kahane's The Rise of David Levinsky. But then again, who was looking? So untouched and uncriticized, Chicago school theories acquired the status of a true conventional wisdom through the end of the Second World War. The 1950s brought with them a new popular vision of the ideal American society, and as a byproduct of the rise to ascendancy of the teachings of cultural pluralism, there came the first substantial questionings of the Chicago school's conceptualizations and predictions. Cultural pluralists had, of course, long argued, from at least the days of the young Horace Cowan around World War I forward, and against both assimilationists and nativists alike, that the greatness of America lay not in the homogeneity of its people, but rather in its heterogeneity. But it was not until the buoyant, expansive, victorious early post-war days that this most progressive of American ideologies eventually superseded the melting pot advocates and the anti-Semitic conformist conceptualizations in the popular mind. For cultural pluralists, the ideal American is one who, upon his or her arrival in America, makes every effort to conform to American ways and aspires towards economic greatness in order to make his ultimate contribution to this country. Along the way, much of his unusual past, those aspects of his European heritage that would set him fully apart from what others are jettisoned. At the same time, this willing American is certain to hold fast to aspects of his ancestral culture or religion, particularly if these pieces of his or her past can be dressed up in American garb. It is this individual, proud of his Americanism and comfortable with his roots, who has the greatest chance of aiding this country's growth. Moreover, American culture itself benefits by the infusion of Jewish or Italian or Polish or Irish symbols or elements. Simply put, we live together, learn from each other, and most importantly, learn to tolerate diversity in culture and society. Within this emerging tolerant atmosphere, it was inevitable the 1920s theories that predicted and maybe even hoped for total assimilation as the ultimate result of the Americanization process would be questioned. And in fact, in the early 1950s, two major works, Will Herbert's Protestant Catholic Jew and Marshall Slayer's Conservative Judaism, did just that, as they argued that the latter areas of immigrant settlements, the neighborhoods closest to or within suburbia, were home still to Jewish identity. As they told the story of immigrant progress and acculturation, and in their case, primarily Jewish progress and acculturation, new Americans did move forward from types of ghettos and identities described in Chicago School towards the newer and better neighborhoods. Significantly, Slayer's particular affinity for the work definition of near West Side Jewish life was predetermined by the fact that he too was also studying Chicago. In second and third settlement neighborhoods, Jews increasingly behaved and achieved like other Americans, just as the early theorists had predicted. But as good 1950s cultural pluralists, Herbert and Speer also argued that the abandonment by Jews of old ways, as they moved towards suburbia, did not leave them devoid of group identities. Rather, they created new ways of linking up with their own kind and their own common past, totally in consonance with American mores. Concretely, that meant that the immigrants transplanted European Orthodox identity that suffered the new arrival, even as it had difficulty dropping roots in hostile American free soil, ultimately did not survive the Americanization and movement of its adherents. But fortunately, the survival of Judaism and the good of America, after a slow start among the marginal, conflicted Jews in second settlement areas where residual Orthodoxy still held on, in the third suburban settlement areas, conservatism came into its own, providing the new American Jews with just the right mix of their past and present, enabling them to remain true to Judaism, making them thereby good Americans. For himself, Herbert added one additional gloss to this description of 1950s Judaism. Out in suburbia, he argued, all religious denominations, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, were in the process of creating an American civil religion, which emphasized shared values as Americans and which played down historical differences. To be sure, Jews still believed differently than did their Christian counterparts, and their weekly religious calendars were uniquely their own. But ultimately, that was a problem only for theologians. Meanwhile, socially, aesthetically, and even architecturally, synagogues were increasingly like churches, and more importantly, churches were like synagogues, as American Judaism, with conservatism being the contestant thereof, took its honored place as an equal in culturally pluralistic America. In time, as the more intensely ethnic 1960s began to unfold, cultural pluralism teachings raised voices in other rooms in the academies. Immigrants and then social historians began to light their own fires, directing their attacks at the start of the Chicago School's immigrant trail. They offered substantial revisions of Burgess, Park, and Work's view, focusing primarily on the physical dynamics of downtown life, and from there, looked closely at the questions of when and how immigrants moved out and beyond ghetto limits. Moses Rishon, author of the classic The Promised City, offered the most telling early critique. True to the teachings of his own mentor, Oscar Hanlon, and attuned as was his senior to the message enunciated to all by the late Marcus Lee Hansen, that the new Americans had to be studied within their own perspective, Rishon set out in detail the saga of the daily life and trials of adjustments of the immigrant on the Lower East Side. Totally conscious of what Wolf had written years ago and years later, Rishon would write, "When in my second year of graduate study I first read Wolf's book, I was quietly incensed that so simplistic a sociological formula should have gone virtually uncontested and obtained universal currency. Rishon was soon to point out, utilizing the nuts and bolts methodologies of the urban historian, how large, variegated, and economically diverse is Jewish life downtown. Hard-nosed examinations of downtown's growth, physical characteristics, population density, and demographic data led him to reveal that both the poor and those Jews on the way up reside each in their own sub-enclaves in the larger area known to outsiders as the Lower East Side. Why didn't these Jews with new money take their affluence and move uptown as they should have? True, downtown was the classic slum neighborhood. Indeed, it had more than even Chicago's share of tenements and dilapidated buildings. But Rishon discovered that New York's zone in transition, to borrow Burgess's phrase, was also a neighborhood which over time frequently changed for the better. Rishon's study of early 20th century New York real estate trends helped him understand how from a less crowded quarter south of East Broadway, where private dwellings, front courtyards, and a scattering of trees, recalling a time when Henry, Madison, Rutgers, and Jefferson Street addresses were stylish, could come into existence. He considered metropolitan urban renewal policies, which permitted him to hint to us how the 1890-1900 public parks movement created a more salubrious setting for some downtowns. All that he understood created a class of denizens of better buildings who, when seen from a wide lens aerial map, were indeed in a first Belmont area, but their bank account tallies were clearly those of second and maybe even third Selma residents. These old rightness stayed downtown possibly because they liked the soul of the old neighborhood or wanted to live near their factory, particularly if as born, they did not have to report to work at 6 a.m. It is equally possible, and this point must be pondered further, that immigrant affluence and acculturation simply did not go hand in hand. The Jew making it economically might not have been ready to tread out of the ghetto. Burgess, Park, and Work were no longer alive in 1963 to rebut Rishon's reputation. Had they lived, they might have posed the following question that we must consider. Could it not be that New York, by virtue of its size or its situation as the major point of immigrant entry, is in fact the idiosyncratic exception that does not undo the Chicagoan's rule? It turned out the next generation of immigrant research addressed that query. Inspired in large measure by Rishon's lead, scholars have demonstrated how immigrants from Jews to Italians to Irish, from New York to Poughkeepsie to Boston to Marblehead and many towns in between, simply did not behave economically or residentially in predictable fashion. One widely evidenced finding was that it was the poor, sometimes more than the new rich, who left the ghetto in search of jobs rather than as a reflection of having made it while still in the ghetto. Another close derivative finding has been that so-called second settlements often manifest first settlement physical characteristics and are home to a floating urban proletariat. Simply put, as I found in doing some work on Harlem, just as there were factory owners living in better built apartments on Madison Street, so there were employable painters living in what became dilapidated tenements on 105th and 3rd Avenue. So much of the 1970s urban immigrant historiography underscored the impossibility of ascribing static patterns of immigrant economic behavior to specifically designated geographical locations. And if what was true of New York was not always applicable to all other places, certainly the Chicago-based paradigm could no longer be used to describe all immigrant patterns of settlements and movements. But what of the residual strength of Chicago School's theory in setting the agenda for historiography on social acculturation, and out of that, our understanding of Jewish denominational life. Wirth had profited, and Square had accepted as true, a stereotypical view of the texture of Jewish identification downtown. Ghetto dwellers were all supposedly ill-attuned to the ways of America. Their soon-to-be tenuous religious identities were rooted in their transplanted European past. The institutional locus of their affiliation was, of course, the ephemeral, if useful, storefront synagogue, a place towards which the Americanizing Jew would increasingly feel uncomfortable. But then again, as Chicago theorist and Slayer had it, by the time the downtown was started losing his faith in the old line shul, he was already on the way uptown. Certainly, for Slayer and for Chicagoans, downtown could not be a place where attempts at the reconciliation of American and Jewish identities might take place. For Slayer, that synthesis would take place well beyond downtown limits. The Chicagoans' attempts at new redefinitions of Judaism would never take place. I have tried to argue, and it is here that I am consciously entering my own work into this historiographical discussion, that just as the Lower East Side proved in reality to have been home to varying economic classes of Jews, so is downtown a center for many shades of European and American styles of Jewish identity. Indeed, there is a significant correlation between the economic and social religious diversity downtown with what we will call American time constituting a key factor in affecting this recognizable heterogeneity. I will presently say, I believe, raises ultimate questions about the applicability of Wirth's work and to some extent of Slayer's as well beyond Chicago and maybe also within Chicago as well. To be sure, the type of European-style synagogue Wirth saw and Slayer understood did predominate on the Lower East Side. In the ephemeral storefront synagogue, Yiddish was the vernacular of discourse and conversation, as Hebrew was the language of prayer. The informality of worship or interaction was rarely observable to any passerby, as Jews looked to these synagogues as not only a place where they could meet God, but equally important as a venue where they could communicate with their own time as beginning Americans seeking to solve the mysteries of this new country. Mosgiel and downtown men of letters, Judah David Eisenstein, probably evoked his contemporary theme best when he described the early days of his own synagogue, the Beit Midrash HaGadol of Norfolk Street. Our synagogue, he wrote, maintains, quote, a socially religious atmosphere, combining piety with pleasure. We called our shul a shtiebel, or prayer club room. We desired to be on familiar terms with the Almighty and abhor decorum. We want everyone present to join and chant the prayers, and above all, we scorn a regularly ordained or trained chanter. Certainly, as Eisenstein notes, these synagogues were more than just bastions of ethnic camaraderie. A portion of these new arrivals were quite pious. Our historian Eisenstein noted the existence within the synagogue of a daily Sefer Mishnayos and a Sefer Shas, and he observed that the religious reliability of the shofet employed by the shul was scrupulously monitored, as was the congregation's baking of matzot. Moreover, this particular synagogue was intimately involved both in 1879 and then in 1887 in the ultimately flawed scheme to create an enduring chief rabbinate in New York, the institutionalization of transplanted European identity and piety. Now, Slayer and Wirth would have had no difficulty with this description, for it ends with the emphasis on the final failure of the transplanted tradition. They would quickly note, and I would concur, that this form of European Judaism had its problems surviving the Americanization of the first generation and the rise to maturity of the second generation. Wirth and Slayer would move the Americanized Jew away from the synagogue and up and out of the ghetto. I am not so ready to move these Jews away, and not so fast, if at all. Rather, I would have a significant cohort stay in the first Selma area considerably longer, and there engage in seemingly uncharacteristic new immigrant behavior in a first Selma neighborhood. They are attempting a positive reconciliation of Jewish and American identities. The first signs of this behavior that was supposed to obtain later, and in second and third settlement areas began in mid-1880s, and within synagogue life, the now maturing Beit Medrash HaGadol. There and then, three concomitant changes took place in the religious lifestyles of those on the road to acculturation, all designed to, or reflective of, the Jews' desire to feel more comfortable and respectable in the synagogue. The earliest East European congregations looked to relocate within their neighborhoods as soon as congregational finances were permitted, from their storefront homes to grand landmark synagogues. This was done either by renovating former churches, by purchasing buildings previously occupied by German congregations, or by building their own new religious edifices. For itself, and as an example, Beit Medrash HaGadol, which began in 1852 in an attic on Bayard Street, purchased in 1885 the Norfolk Street Baptist Church and moved into the Gothic Revival building. In these buildings, of which they could be proud, they could show them off to Gentile friends, that is, of course, if they possessed Gentile friends, services were conducted largely as they had been in the past. But the demeanor of worshippers was noticeably different. To be sure, men still sat separate from women, the siddur was followed without abridgment, and the time of prayers was not altered. However, gone now was the prayer club intimacy that earlier characterized synagogue life. Decorum, always the first call of acculturated groups in dressing up their services, was strongly emphasized. The maintenance of order was furthered by the assignment of seats or pews. This new formality, ostensibly doing what they thought Americans did, was intensified further in the late 1880s when four of New York's landmark East European congregations embarked upon what one historian has aptly described as the Chazon craze. Remember, Eisenstein has told us that as newly arrived immigrants, worshippers had scorned cantors. But as Americanized Jews in late 1880s, Beit Medrash HaGadol people were raised to pay the well-known cantor Israel Michalowski a large salary. They did so to keep themselves competitive with their sister congregation, the Haradash Yeshurun, which in 1886 shocked downtown society by engaging one Reverend T. Minkowski for the then staggering sum of $5,000 per annum. The Suvlak and Cavalier were also impressed, and they went out and hired, quote, their own men of foreign melodies. The point is that for Americanized immigrants, and significantly, Eisenstein refers to them as the young reformers, unquote, these cantors were well worth the investment. They brought elegance and respectability to the services. Moreover, for synagogue leaders, failure to acquiesce to this new trend was tantamount to institutional suicide. They understood that immigrants on the way up, socially and economically, would not pray in synagogues beneath their station. But who were these change makers? Clearly they were Jews living downtown who had made their first money. In fully voluntaristic America, someone had to have paid the $85,000 cost of constructing the Haradach Yeshurun's Moorish-style sanctuary center on Elder Street. And in many ways, they were Americanizing. For example, look to the fact that in building this building, they engaged the Herzog brothers, a Christian architectural firm, to construct their synagogue. Why did these Jews on their way up remain downtown? Now here, several social, psychological, and logistical considerations must be underscored. For some, they stayed downtown because of a desire to be innovative leaders and powerful within their own ethnic community may have kept them close to the synagogue and the sanctuary's eastern wall. For them, Americanization did not lead on a straight line to assimilation. For others, they stayed downtown because of their sense of the incompleteness of their own social acculturation, even as they were clearly doing well economically in America. That kept them in proximity to their own kind. Finally, for almost all whiteness, there was a very basic question in 1880s, 1890s New York of where, if they wanted to go, could they take their new affluence and identity. As alluded to earlier, the history of the metropolis's fiscal growth in the 19th and 20th century was quite different from Chicago's. In New York, because of real estate and transportation problems, second settlement neighborhoods came into being significantly after large numbers of rising immigrant Jews might have had use for them. In essence, by 1890, there were East European Jews in New York well ahead of their fellows in Americanization and of their city in their residential desires. How did this happen and where these overachievers come from? To answer this question, we have to factor into our discussion one additional and critical element, an understanding of American time and of the periodization of East European Jewish migration. Understandably, the standard periodization which marks the start of East European migration to America in 1881 and the rise of the second generation Jewry of Russo-Polish heritage from 1921 has great merits. The pogroms of 81 inaugurated that steady stream that brought 2.25 million Jews over the next 40 years to these shores, and the 1921 date is useful both because it recognizes the import of government quotas legislation and the social coming of age of the majority of the next generation of Americans. Still, this is devastating for all the value of two historical realities that are important to us. First, there were between 40 to 50,000 Jews of Russian Polish descent in this country before 1881. Their presence was noted a generation ago by Professors Marcus and Barone in their predating of the period to 1852 and 1863, respectively. By 1890, these Jews who had come before the 1880s had been here long enough both to have arrived economically as well as to have raised a second generation reaching its majority. These old new immigrants and their children might have relocated uptown and worked there for the development of a new American Judaism if only there had been second settlement neighborhoods ready. They would have been joined in their hegira uptown by a second distinct and often overlooked cohort of East European Jews, the migrants of the early 1880s who either had made it financially or had matured as Americans stronger and faster than did their fellows. Clearly, these immigrant overachievers did not need the predicted or assigned amount of American time, basically 20 or 30 years, to reach here a higher level of economic and social mobility. In effect, they could not wait until the 1900s to be part of the mass aggregate of acculturating and openly mobile Jews, so noticed by historians as the ones who created the large-scale demand for housing in New York that ultimately brought new neighborhoods and new forms of Judaism uptown. But wait, they had to on the Lower East Side, and as they did, they conducted an important early experimentation on the reconciliation of Judaism with America. What became of his innovators and their experiments after the new post-1900 second settlement neighborhoods were constructed in New York? Sclair would have those with the new ideas on the road out towards suburbia with a real action against assimilation was seemingly about to begin. In so doing, of course, Sclair would render our discussion of the 1890s Lower East Side activity as merely an early footnote to a later process that took place elsewhere. Once again, I'm not so prepared to immediately move all Jews with new ideas from the Lower East Side, even if they had money, social confidence, and new neighborhoods beckoning. Religious innovation and experimentation continues to characterize downtown life. Indeed, it intensified through the World War I period, even as parallel efforts obtained, particularly for Slayer, in uptown neighborhoods. Young people's synagogues on the Lower East Side, whether they bore the name the Jewish Endeavor Society pre-1910 or the Young Israel post-1913, offered both late first and rapidly maturing second generation Jews that mixture of social and religious services characteristics of the American synagogue and normally associated only with the suburban areas. In truth, the fundamental difference between the ghetto American synagogues pre-World War I and those situated towards or in suburbia lay not in their appreciation of America, but in their fidelity to Jewish tradition. Simply plotted on the map, the degree of deviation from the Jewish ceremonial, calendar, clock, and liturgical path became increasingly acute as synagogues were built further and further from the hub. but the commitment to offering Jews American social options was basically the same wherever institutions were built before World War I. By whom and for whom were these synagogues built pre-World War I? They were built by Jews who began their American careers in the 1870s, 1880s, and in Stiebels, who had watched how the pressures of this new land undermined the commitment of their friends, even as they had their own problems with some aspects of the past, while remaining true to the essences of the traditions. These builders were resolved by later to turn of the century to helping their own generation, and most importantly, their children, make their own positive reconciliations. We know from the memoir literature that positions like these were taken both by Jewish innovators in the ghetto and without, and both by Jews who wanted to occupy and by Jews who were willing to share the sanctuary's eastern walls, sharing the wealth and kavod was more endemic to uptown than downtown. As a subsidiary point, it should be noted that there was opposition to their stands, both without downtown and uptown, a note to ponder as you look at the persistence or lack of persistence under American time and through areas of settlement of the oldest ways. The synagogues downtown were built for second generation youngsters who might be more acculturated than affluent. These second generation Jews from poor downtown homes could find no currency, relevance, or solace in the Stiebel, but looked to possibly holding on to something of their Jewishness if only they could be shown how. Their more affluent friends, maybe a classmate of CCNY, might have shared his sentiments and hope and did find a synagogue to his liking uptown. Their sisters might also have been attracted to these American places of worship, as they too might have become estranged from the storefront synagogues that they had rarely attended. Invariably, these synagogues were ministered to by young second-generation American-trained rabbis or rabbinic interns, students at Reitz or the Jewish Radical Seminary, with careers as American Orthodox or conservative rabbis ahead of them. There is abundant literature on that sideline, but that is a topic for another day, and were less successful than their fellows. Others came here later and were quicker in their rise. Some were ultimately anxious to assimilate and made their move as soon as circumstances permitted. Others held closely or loosely to a variety of Jewish traditions and expressions. Some of these Jewish lifestyles were typically New York-like, but so many more had to be found both in inner city and outer rich communities elsewhere. And all are worthy of study and characterization as the historiography of immigrant life from downtown to beyond matures further. Thank you very much.
We have still time, and our two speakers will appreciate very much questions. So I'll be more. And you don't have to direct your question to a author given to you or to the superior, because the question itself will say who shall answer it. Please.
Before Cheryl chooses to be overly legalistic again in the 19th century as a result of the Chinese, of the prisoners trying to show themselves to be more of an Indian sect. Yet, I say take the example of immersion events in which Tarak Jews are overly legalistic. That's the 16th century. Could you clarify that?
I just need to say that the notion originates de novo in the 19th century. The argument that Jesus himself said at one point that my burden is light compared with that of the law, the notion of the yoke of the law appears in the medieval text as well. The argument is only that the dynamic of the Christian interpretation of the nature of Christianity itself in the 19th century compelled a focus on this point, the point where it was the essential argument for Christianity itself to survive as a viable, worthwhile religion. If a medieval Christian would have given up this argument, wouldn't have mattered. So it's another argument, I'll do without it, I'll list four or five other arguments. The kind of Christians I'm talking about now didn't really believe, and to put it bluntly, they didn't really believe in the incarnation anymore, they didn't really believe in the virgin birth anymore, they didn't believe in the Trinity anymore. They believed in, but they didn't believe in Christianity. You know, like the famous story about the Russia, about the rabbi got a Roman shul, and he spoke the first Shabbos about the Shabbos, and the Christian probably didn't get fired because everybody was called Shabbos, so the next day, he spoke about Dr. Shiboka, and the Christian probably was crazy, so he spoke about the Shabbos, practice, whatever he said first. And finally, after what I talk about, and the president said, talk about Judaism. This is a precise analogy almost. So what left? Christianity. Alright, but what is Christianity? Yes, Christianity is the ethical dimension. That made this disintegration of Jewish ethics is friendship to Christian argument. Well, in the past, it was, you know, one argument against this.
Professor Ginsberg, please.
I didn't read the Kaufman's motive argument, only his condensement against his heavy beguilement. His own condensement, only part of your list. What I would like to know is, how do we treat the discussions of the middle of the 19th century, these critical scholars that are known, where there was a smell of Jesus? In fact, a Jewish writer, he said, Meir Zetter, prayed for apologetic reasons, in order not to no Jew should not be considered guilty and deified, he didn't take it off. Does Kaufman, in his words, does he reflect upon this discussion?
You know, Kaufman takes Jesus' existence for granted. Kaufman wrote after that period of extreme skepticism had really been over, had really ended. Our friend Dinard did write a book called he wrote a book arguing for Jesus' non-existence entitled with his typical cleverness Ya'ar V'ein Do. Ya'ar V'ein Do. Lugubim V'lo Ya'an. But the captain takes it for granted that Jesus is
To what extent did it fuel Christianity, like for example
that it was actually an ethical mission, as on the whole among 18th century and 19th century. Well, I mean, in certain sense, the Gaffer Vendor's approach is the approach that dominated, but not in its idiosyncratic form. What is peculiar to the Gaffer Vendor is the notion that Christianity, Jesus and Paul, had a nullified mission, right? Basically that they were the precursors of the prophets. That remained in the US.
So,
Professor, how long do you expand, what did you say about Jesus? Is Fatou Bedin the Sulu Arawilo?
I'm sorry?
Is Fatou Bedin the Sulu Arawilo? When you say that there is no basis for the purpose of the Mishnaic law, did you know Mishnaic law or Jewish law?
So, there is no basis, in my view, for the execution of Jesus on the grounds that Kaufman argues. You know, there are certainly grounds for executing Jesus, provided that you attribute to Jesus a properly capital crime. As if you regard him as an execution of Mashiach, then, of course, he could probably be executed. The Rambam probably did regard him as an execution of Mashiach. Although I can't really be sure, the Rambam doesn't really tell us things. What I'm saying is that, given Kaufman's presentation of what he considers to be a ground for execution, I think.
Something that doesn't exist anymore. In other words, totally out of cover.
Let me respond in two ways. Number one,
sociology. Wouldn't it be nice to say what's actually happening today, but also sociology is a history, but let's study the true growth movement in American Jewish life, the Kamar, the Flatbush movement. Well, let's say Russian Jewish immigrants or Israeli immigrants, which is growing more than American Jewish life today. I project, and I don't know if anyone has a separate project, what's going to happen to the American Jewish community a generation from now when suburban people are.
Let me start responding in two different ways. Number one, the questions you raise are more fitting to people trained in the field of sociology than history. The irony of your question is that people who do American Jewish history seriously, and I think I do, my colleagues do, are often accused by people who do medieval and ancient history of doing current events. We've always tried this current event in comparison to what we've heard the rest of this conference. This is the first time I've been told that what I should do is predict the future and study the past. At best, we're trying, in working in American Jewish history, to submit the more recent history, the same types of critical analyses that people did for earlier periods. My teacher, Naomi Cohen, used to say that when she did work on Zionism, people would say to her, but I heard Stephen White say what he said, and he's something totally different than what you have said. And she said, well, I have the copy of the speech in front of me. It makes a difference. I've heard this. No one could say that about in this century before the common era figure. That's what we deal with. So no, I'm not about to involve myself in picking the future. That's left to a variety of people, but not the historians.
Mm-hmm. Let me just close it off.
I'm just going to rise for a moment to take the opportunity of thanking all of the speakers of yesterday and today, those who came from Eretz Yisrael and those from the American scene. I think the quality of the speakers was just excellent. I also want to thank the Michael Sharp Publication Trust, whose generous grant made this conference possible. And last but certainly not least, I would like to thank all the remnants of the people who were here both yesterday and today for coming, and we hope in the future, let me not predict either sociologically or historically, that we will have another conference in the future again. Thanks very much for coming.